And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bobick, which means once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about 2.5 months, titled The 57 Bus. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Big Bed for Jed. And then it's Cheerful Chick, Dinosaurs for Dylan, The Little Wooden Robot, and The Log Princess. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Maybe You Might. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled A Big Bed for Jed. Jed loved his crib. It felt just right, till his family surprised him with a big bed one night. "It's here," said Mom, "the bed that you chose. Are you ready to try it?" Jed just froze. "Hop in," Mom said. "You know what to do." "I can't," said Jed. "It's so big and so new." "But you've grown," said Dad. "Your crib is too small." "I'll fall out," said Jed, and roll down the hall. "Not with these," said his sister. "They match your hair." "I only like blue," said Jed, "everywhere. And those are guardrails on the outside of the bed." "We brought you pajamas," said Jed's Auntie Stella. "We think you'll love them now that you're a big fella." "There's more," said Uncle Stan, "new pillows and a spread." "There's no room," said Jed, "we can't fit in this bed." "Nonsense," said Dad. "Now, not one more peep." Dad phoned up Grandma. "Jed won't go to sleep." Grandma rushed over. She picked up Jed. "Dear grandson," said Grandma, "please get in that bed." Jed crossed his arms. "I will not go." He crawled under his crib, crying, "No, no, no, no." "Move the crib," sighed Dad. Grandma rolled it out the door. Mom threw up her hands. "I can't take any more." "We give up," said Aunt Stella. "We're leaving," said Uncle Stan. "Wait," yelled Jed's sister. "What we need is a plan." As they started to whisper, the group drew in tight, whispering ps, 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 till their plan was just right. "Sweet dreams," yawned Uncle Stan. "I'm going to sleep." He slipped in Jed's bed and began to count sheep. Aunt Stella climbed in and started to snore. Jed's sister was next. Then Grandma made four. Mom and Dad got in last. They mumbled, "Goodnight." "Dear Jed," whispered Grandma, "please turn out the light." "But that's my big bed." And there wasn't a doubt. Now that they were all in, Jed wanted them out. "Shh," said his sister, "we're trying to sleep." "Keep it down," said Uncle Stan. "You'll wake up the sheep." Auntie Stella let out a great snort and a snore. And Dad said, "Well, Jed, I guess you get the floor." Jed started to think. Now what could he do to get them all out? Suddenly, he knew. Jed bounced on his sister. He sat on his dad. He rolled on his grandma. Mom cried out, "Egad!" He tossed up the pillows and hid under the sheet. And they all squirmed and giggled when Jed tickled their feet. Especially Aunt Stella, who hollered, "What fun!" as Uncle Stan led them out of the bed one by one. Then Jed pulled up the covers of his great big new bed. "See you in the morning," was all that he said. He got lots of kisses and lots of good nights. It was bedtime at Jed's. Mom turned out the lights. Cheerful Chick. Once inside a chicken's nest, a dozen eggs, all grade A best, lay still and warm, their contents sleeping, all but one, who came out peeping. This sunny chicken loved to cheer, though grown-ups groaned when she came near. She needs to understand we're busy, and her cheering makes us dizzy. Cheerful Chick worked day and night until at last her moves felt right. And then she hatched her lifelong dream to build a barnyard cheering team. She got her muscles good and warm and did her moves with perfect form. Side splits, wing stands, super punches, Chicken shook her feathers bunches. Then, because her dream was big, she made her pitch to Mr. Pig. "When I say three, yell P-I-G. This fellow's jumps, a treat to see." Mr. Pig, often grumpy, 'cause his slops were cold and lumpy, flicked his tail and said, "Shove off, I'm very busy at my trough." Chick shrugged her wings. "I bet Miss Cow would like to do some cheering now." Jumpin' Miss Cow, 100% organic, fresh milk, next exit. Miss Cow knows all the wildest moves. Just watch her stand on two front hooves. Miss Cow just stood and blinked and chewed and said, "I'm so not in the mood." And so, without another peep, Chick went in search of Mr. Sheep. "Now come on, farm gang, don't be drips. Let's count to 10 as sheep does flips." But when she counted, Mr. Sheep did not do flips. He fell asleep. Poor chicken hung her little head. Her tiny heart filled up with dread. In the barn stood one last choice. She needed time to find her voice. "Now snap your beak and stomp your feet, 'cause horses' high kicks can't be beat." Mrs. Horse just stared at Chick, who felt as though she might be sick. She touched her wings as if to pray, and Mrs. Horse responded, "Nay." Chick gave it everything she could, but nothing did her any good. She chucked her pom-poms in the trough, and then she ripped her sweater off, 'cause no one cared about her dream, and no one wanted on her team. She whispered so that none would hear, "Who am I if I cannot cheer?" Chick sat and watched the full moon rise. And as she did, she realized she didn't need those other folk, just wings and legs and lots of yolk. She gave herself one last routine, where every move was strong and clean. Then something happened as she cheered. A squad of fluffy friends appeared. Some cheerful chicks, 11 more. Not that she was keeping score. "Well, hey now, horse, pig, cow, and sheep. This farm is full of chicks that cheep. We're two chicks, four chicks, six, a dozen. Watch us get this barnyard buzzin'." Since the grown-ups' work was done, they took part in the cheering fun, and Cheerful Chick knew dreams come true when chicks do what they're born to do. Dinosaurs for Dylan. Dad, how do you spell Duplodocus? Ellie asked. She was sitting at the kitchen table, drawing a picture, while her dad cooked supper. Duck what? He said. Duplodocus, she said again. You know, the dinosaur. Oh, Diplodocus, he said. D-I-P-L, wait. Why do you need to know how to spell that? I'm drawing a picture for Dylan, Ellie said. I want him to be my friend, and he really likes dinosaurs. Good idea. Is Dylan in your class? Sometimes, Ellie said, frowning. Sometimes? Dad turned around from the stove to look at Ellie. Yeah, Ellie looked up at him. Sometimes he goes to the reset zone. With Miss Costello. Reset zone? What's that? Daddy asked when he walked into the kitchen to help set the table. Oh, it's a place where you can go if you need to breathe, Ellie told them. Ellie's dad looked at each other with raised eyebrows. Do you mean it's a place to go if you need to calm down because you're frustrated or mad? Dad asked Ellie. Yeah, frustrated, Ellie said. Dylan sometimes yells and throws toys. Mrs. Grimes says that's not safe. So when Dylan gets frustrated, he goes to the reset zone with Miss Costello. Daddy nodded. Your teacher is right, Ellie. Throwing toys isn't safe. Ellie huffed. I know that, Daddy. Okay, Pumpkin. Dad smiled at her as he turned off the stove. I'm glad to hear it. It's time to eat, baby, Daddy said. Please put your stuff and wash. Put away your stuff and wash your hands. Ellie put away her art supplies and told her dad more about Dylan. Dylan seems sad sometimes, and I want to help him feel better, Ellie explained. He plays with dinosaurs all the time. The Duplodocus is his favorite, so I drew that one for him. Ellie pointed to the drawing on the counter. I want to write the name on it too, she said. All right, Dad said. I'll spell it for you after we eat. As Ellie and her dad ate, she shared even more about Dylan. He doesn't talk a lot, but he does use his hands. And Miss Costello knows what he wants. So he uses sign language? Daddy asked. I guess so. Ellie considered this, but not all the time. He does say some things. Well, I'm glad you want to be friends with him, Dad said. I'm sure he'll love the dinosaur picture you drew. I hope so, Ellie said, glancing proudly at the picture on the counter. I can give it to him tomorrow before the bell rings. Daddy glanced at the picture, too. Just don't get too close to Dylan, he warned. What's that supposed to mean, Roman? Dad asked sharply. I'm sure Ellie's teacher and Dylan's paraprofessional work very hard to make sure all of the children are safe and feel loved. Ellie looked back and forth between her dad's, confused and a little worried at Dad's rough voice. Daddy reached across the table and put his hand on Dad's arm. Your dad's right, Ellie. Your teacher and the staff are great. If you want, I'll help you draw another picture for Dylan after dinner. Thanks, Daddy, said Ellie, relieved that Dad seemed happy again. A couple days later, Ellie's dad saw her looking at a blank piece of drawing paper. Another dinosaur for Dylan? He asked. Ellie looked up at him with tears in her eyes. Ellie, sweetie, what's wrong? Dad asked. Dylan doesn't like me, she sobbed. Dad sat down next to her. Oh, baby, I'm sure that he does. No, he doesn't, Ellie cried. He won't take my pictures or play with me. Dad leaned closer to Ellie. What do you mean? Well, when I try to give them to him, he just yells and waves his hands. Mrs. Costello takes them from me and puts them in a school bag. Well, maybe Dylan doesn't know how to say thank you, Dad said. Or maybe he's so excited to see your beautiful pictures that he doesn't know what to say. Maybe, Ellen said, taking a deep breath and wiping her eyes. I guess I can make him a different dinosaur this time. Good idea, Dad said, giving her a squeeze. Ellie hugged him, then took out a bright green crayon and started drawing. The open house banner in front of the school made Ellie bounce with excitement as the family pulled into the parking lot the following night. Come on, Dad! Come on, Daddy! Ellie yelled to her dads as she towed them by the hands across the school parking lot. I have to show you my classroom. Okay, okay, her dads laughed. We're coming. Ellie pulled her dads through the door to her class. She ran across the room to a rectangular table and started to jump up and down. See, see, she beamed at them. This is where I sit. We see, Ellie, Daddy said, grinning at Dad as they walked over to her. It's a great table. Ellie's dads picked up the packets of papers with her name on them. As they stood together, reading the notes and looking at Ellie's pictures, Mrs. Grimes came over with another mom and dad. Good evening, she said. I'm Ellie's teacher, Mrs. Grimes. She held out her hand to Ellie's daddy. Well, it's nice to meet you, Daddy said. I'm Roman, and this is Trevor. Ellie's dads shook hands with her teacher. Mrs. Grimes gestured to the other parents. This is Mr. and Mrs. Jacoby, she said. My student Dylan is their son. They wanted to meet you. Dylan's mom smiled at Ellie's dads. We wanted to tell you how lucky we feel that Ellie is in Dylan's class. When Ellie heard her name, she looked up at Dylan's mom and dad. Why? She asked. He doesn't like me. Oh, no. Dylan's mom crouched down in front of Ellie. Dylan really, really likes you. Your wonderful dinosaur pictures are all over his room. He pats them every night before he goes to bed. Really? Ellie pouted. He doesn't want to play with me. Mrs. Jacoby smiled at Ellie. It's difficult for Dylan to let someone know he likes them. Ellie thought about that and nodded. Our neighbor, Mrs. Delaney, is the same way. Ellie's dads shared a grin. Mr. Jacoby smiled. Sometimes making new friends is hard. Dylan might show that he likes someone or something differently than we do. But I can tell he likes you, Dylan's mom said to Ellie. You're a kind and thoughtful girl. Ellie ducked her head and blushed. Thank you, Mr. Jacoby said. As the Jacobys walked away, Dad picked up Ellie and gave her a squeeze. The next morning, when Ellie sat down at her table, she noticed a small plastic dinosaur toy by her name tag. When she picked it up to look at it, she heard Dylan say, Diplodocus, Diplodocus. Ellie turned to see Dylan on the carpet with Mrs. Costello, playing with other plastic dinosaur toys, just like the one in her hand. Miss Costello winked at Ellie and smiled. Ellie squeezed the toy and smiled, too. The Little Wooden Robot and the Log Princess. There once lived a king and queen who happily ruled a pleasant land, but they had no children. So one night, the king went to see the royal inventor, and the queen went to see a clever old witch who lived in the woods. They both asked for the same thing, a child. The inventor set to work straight away. She used her finest tools and her most ingenious designs, and she built a wonderful, intricate little wooden robot. The witch took a log from the basket by her fire and used her deepest magic to bring the wood to life in the form of a perfect little log princess. The king and the queen and the princess and the robot all loved each other instantly. The log princess was bold and clever, but she had a secret. Each night when she fell asleep, she turned back into a log and would stay like that until she was woken by the magic words, "Awake, little log, awake." The little wooden robot was brave and kind. So kind, in fact, that he let a family of beetles nest in his workings, even though it tickled sometimes. Every day, the robot would wake his log sister, and they would play in the castle and the gardens until the sun went down and they were tired out. However, one morning, a traveling circus came to visit, and the robot rushed down to the courtyard without waking his sister. On the stairs, he passed a maid going up to tidy the princess's bedroom. When the maid saw the log, she said, "Oh dear, a plain old log lying in the princess's bed. What a disgrace!" and threw it out of the window. At that very moment, the little robot thought of his sister. "How selfish of me," he said to himself. "She's missing out on all these wonderful things." And he ran to her bedroom to wake her up. He looked at the empty bed in horror. "Where's the log?" he cried. "Oh, that," said the maid. "I threw it out the window." The robot looked out and spied the log rolling across the courtyard. He raced down, but the castle was atop a steep hill, and the log had rolled through the gate, over the drawbridge, and down toward the village. A goblin was pushing a barrow of logs through the village, and the princess log rolled right up to him. "What a lucky day," he said. "Another fine log for my load." The goblin took the logs to the river where a barge was tied up. The captain paid him a copper coin, and his barrow load was tipped into the barge with hundreds and hundreds of other logs. The robot ran to the barge. "Please, sir," he said to the captain, "my special log is in your barge. May I come aboard and search for it?" "You may," said the captain, "but we must set sail straight away while the wind is right." So the robot clambered on, and the barge set off for the frozen north. They sailed for days, but there were so many logs that, even with the help of the crew, the little wooden robot could not find the right one. They arrived and unloaded the cargo. "Come back with us," said the captain. "The north is a dangerous place, and we can easily find you another log when we get home." "I can't," said the robot. "That log is the most precious thing in the world to me. I won't leave without it." So the crew gave him a map, some supplies, and a hand cart, and sailed back to the pleasant land where our story began. The night was long and cold. The little wooden robot shivered as he searched. Then something caught his eye, something familiar. He reached into the pile and pulled out a log. It was the princess. He danced for joy with the log in his arms and was about to recite the magic words when he realized how awful it would be for his poor sister, who had fallen asleep in her cozy little bed, to wake here, freezing and far from home. so he put her into the hand cart, tucked a blanket around her, took up the handle, and began the long walk home. Along the way, he had too many adventures to recount here. The giant's key, the family of robbers, the old lady in a bottle, the magic pudding, the lonely bear, the queen of mushrooms. But each left him more exhausted than the last. His joints became stiff, and his cogs and gears wore down, until one day he could go no further. With the last of his strength, he said the magic words, woke the princess, and told her what had happened, how it was all his fault, and that he understood that she would probably never forgive him. "Oh, brother," she said, "how silly of you to keep all these worries to yourself. Of course I forgive you." She helped him into the hand cart, where he fell into a deep sleep. She took the map and the handle of the cart and continued the walk home. She, too, had many adventures. The mischievous pixies, the dragon's egg, the feuding hunters, the haunted well, the enormous blackbird, the baby in a rose bush. The princess knew that whatever happened, however tired she felt, she must not fall asleep. But one night, as she was trudging through a dark forest, which she was sure couldn't be that far from home, she began to yawn. And then she yawned some more, and her eyes felt heavy, and her legs felt tired, and she thought of her cozy little bed in the castle. "Perhaps I shall close my eyes just for a moment," she said, and with that she fell asleep and, pop, turned into a log. The king and queen missed their children terribly. Soldiers had been sent searching in every direction, and a huge reward had been offered. But it was no good. The queen would not leave her bed, and the king sat alone in a tower, staring out at the deep, dark forest. Little did he know that in the forest was a clearing, and in that clearing was a hand cart, and in the hand cart was a little wooden robot, and in that robot's worn-out, broken-down workings, a family of beetles was wondering why everything was so still and so quiet. They climbed out and looked at the log and the robot and knew that they must do something. So they stopped a passing mouse and asked her for help. And she asked a bird, who asked a rabbit, who asked a fox. And they all worked together to take the princess and the robot to the nearest house, the home of a clever old witch. The witch recognized the pair immediately. She woke the princess, repaired the robot, and set off for the castle. The king could hardly believe his eyes as he watched the little group, all crowded onto a broomstick, fly over the forest and set down in the castle courtyard. The robot and the princess and the queen and the king all hugged and laughed and cried. The witch was thanked. The month was declared a holiday for the whole kingdom. The beetles were each given a tiny golden medal. And they all lived happily ever after. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now for about 2.5 months, titled The 57 Bus, a true story of two teenagers and the crime that changed their lives. One teenager in a skirt, one teenager with a lighter. One moment that changed both of their lives forever. If it weren't for the 57 bus, Sasha and Richard never would have met. Both were high school students in Oakland, California, one of the most diverse cities in the country. But they inhabited different worlds. Sasha lived in the middle-class foothills and attended a small private school. Richard lived in the economically challenged flatlands and attended a large public one. After school each day, their paths overlapped on the bus for a mere 8 minutes. But one afternoon, a single reckless act left Sasha severely burned and Richard charged with 2 hate crimes and facing life imprisonment. The case garnered international attention, thrusting both teenagers into the spotlight. But in The 57 Bus, author Daishika Slater shows that what might at first seem like a simple matter of right and wrong, justice and injustice, victim and criminal, is something more complicated and far more heartbreaking. This true story, first chronicled in the New York Times Magazine by Slater and artfully, compassionately, and expertly expanded upon here, is a riveting exploration of race, class, gender, identity, morality, and forgiveness. Told with honesty and insight, gleaned from both teens' lives, The 57 Bus will inspire you to rethink all you know about crime, punishment, and empathy. Okay, last week we learned 6 days after getting arrested, the DA decided to charge Richard as an adult. Even after Richard was told his Miranda rights, he still talked to 2 police officers. After Richard told the officers a wrong story, what happened on the bus, the officers showed Richard photographs from the video taken on the bus of him and his 2 friends. Richard said he did it because he was homophobic. Remember, Sasha is agender, neither man or woman, but wearing a skirt. Now they are describing the booking procedure at the county jail. And that's where I left off last week. Once they locate your paperwork, they'll start booking you in. You get 2 phone calls. One to a parent or guardian, the other to your employer if you have a job, or your probation officer if you're on probation. Then you get a medical screening. Are you on medication? Any injuries in the last 24 hours? They'll offer you an HIV test, and if you're a girl, a pregnancy test. If you've been here before, you already have a medical file. They'll thumb through it, checking up. How's your asthma? They might ask. Then it's time for photographs and fingerprinting. They document your scars and tattoos. Put your prints in the database. And then you're done, booked in. The whole thing takes less than an hour. Down a long hallway with mustard-colored walls, the floor is linoleum, shiny, clean, patterned in squares of tan, yellow, and beige. Younger kids charged with serious crimes go into Unit 4, one of 2 maximum security units. Each unit has 30 single rooms spread over 2 tiers, one upper, one lower. These days, the units are only half full. The doors are blue, the stairs are blue, the rooms are yellow and bare of anything except a single blue bunk, a steel sink and toilet, and a call box by the door, 8 feet by 8 feet and brightly lit, a steel door with a square of window. If you like most kids, once the door slams behind you, you'll stand at that window looking out. There's not much else to look at, unless you count your blurred reflection in the metal mirror over the sink. Nothing to do but look at the sliver of the world you can see through that square glass, or lie down on the blue vinyl-covered mattress, shut your eyes, try to get your heart to stop banging against the wall of your chest. You won't be leaving the unit anytime soon, except for court appearances and the weekend visiting hours. 3 hours on Saturday or Sunday, parents or guardians only, no siblings. Aside from PE, which takes place in the gym down the hall, and a visit to the medical unit, everything you do, you'll do here, in this unit, with these same people. School is here, meals are here, chapel's here, a barber comes in twice a week to give haircuts in the chair in the corner. The nurse comes here, the counselors too. The rec yard is just outside the door. There's another rec yard, big and open, 3 basketball hoops. It's surrounded by razor wire, but also by hills and trees and sky. A 360-degree view of the world. The world. But if you've been charged as an adult, you can't go out there. Your exercise will take place on the rectangular yard outside the unit, 30 yards by 20 yards by 20 yards, with a mural of wildlife hanging above the basketball backstop. Tilt your head back and you see a pie-shaped wedge of sky through a screen of wire mesh. After they book you in for something serious, murder, attempted murder, setting a person on fire on a bus, they put you in a camera room for the first 24 hours. They know that as soon as you're alone, it's going to hit you, what you did, what could happen. So they watch to make sure you don't become your own next victim. Surgery. The first morning in the hospital, Sasha was overcome by anxiety. They didn't want to eat, couldn't keep anything down. It's a common reaction to losing your skin. Cold, clammy fear. That's why sedatives and anti-anxiety medicines are as much a part of burn treatment as painkillers. Sasha needed to eat. Burn victims require extra nutrition to heal, and Sasha wasn't a big eater to begin with. The hospital nutritionist wanted to give them a nutritional supplement through a feeding tube that would be inserted through their nose. Sasha objected at first because the supplement wasn't vegan, but Debbie and Carl persuaded them to set aside their principles just this once. "This is going to get you out of here sooner," they promised. The next morning, November the 6th, Sasha went into surgery. In the operating room, Dr. Grossman shaved away at the burned, dead skin, cutting away thin layers until he reached bleeding tissue. Then he covered the open wound with a temporary graft of pig skin. This xenograft, as it's called, would stay in place until the underlying tissue had regenerated enough to supply blood to the skin graft. By now, Sasha's name was on the news. As Debbie and Carl stood at the nurse's station, talking with the burn unit's director, a call came from the lobby. Someone was there to visit Sasha. He said his name was Max, and he claimed to be a pastor from Sasha's hometown. After that, Debbie and Carl drew up a short list of approved visitors, along with a plan for dealing with the press. That evening, Sasha checked out the news coverage online, but the spectacle didn't hold their interest. Their mind drifted, dulled by painkillers and sedatives. News from the outside world was like listening to the radio on a drive through the mountains. The distant voices clear for a moment, then warbling, and then washing into static. Debbie and Carl didn't talk to Sasha about it, but Debbie had spoken to one of the police officers who had interviewed Richard. She took notes on what he told her about Richard. He actually said he's homophobic. He giggled. Still kinda dying. Michael messaged Healy at 7:02 p.m. on Wednesday, November the 6th. Michael, hey, you there? Healy, yes, Jesus. Michael, how are you? Healy, tapping a random assortment of keys. I got to text Sasha while I was babysitting. That was nice. Michael, nice. Yeah, I caught them on Skype earlier. Hey, Gmail says they're online. Glad to see they're awake. Healy, yes, I was just texting them like 20 minutes ago. Michael, indeed. Nemo and I are visiting him tomorrow. Them? Oh, that's nice. I wish I could. Didn't know they were allowed visitors. Well, maybe I'll go on Friday. I can bring them a pic of Sasha's skirt day. Michael, Sasha's skirt day? Didn't you hear? We're all wearing skirts on Friday for Sasha, and we're gonna take a pic. Michael, no one told me this. I approve. Healy, I'm going to wear a skirt. It's a big deal. I hate skirts. Michael, heh. Does Sasha know of this yet? Healy, no. It's a surprise. No telling. Michael, this is going to be fun. Healy, yes, it is. How are you feeling? Michael, a lot better. Taking a day off was a good idea. Healy, that's good. Getting to talk to them helped me, but I'm still kind of dying. Now I feel like shit, and I'm not done with my HW. Michael, yeah, I didn't get much work done today either. I have a late night ahead of me. Healy, I can't sleep. Every time I close my eyes, I freak out. I didn't sleep except for maybe an hour or two last night. Michael, I was exhausted, personally. I fell asleep as soon as my head hit the pillow. Healy, yeah, but think about it. They woke up and they were on fire. Charges. 2 days after Richard's arrest, the district attorney's office released his name to the media. He was being charged as an adult, which meant he no longer had the protection given to juveniles, one of which is anonymity. They charged him with two felonies, aggravated mayhem and assault with intent to cause great bodily injury. Each charge also contained a hate crime clause that would increase Richard's sentence by an additional 1 to 3 years in state prison. If convicted, he faced a maximum sentence of life in prison, a punishment he would never have faced if he had been charged as a juvenile. Richard's violent and senseless criminal conduct resulted in severe and traumatic injuries to a young and entirely innocent victim. Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley said, "The intentional and callous nature of the crime is shocking and will not be tolerated in our community." Lloyd and Jamal were never interviewed, arrested, or charged. Direct files. Stop right here, and for a moment, imagine yourself forced to submit to being handcuffed and see what kind of feelings will be aroused in you. A Chicago lawyer named John P. Altgeld wrote in an 1884 book called Our Penal Machinery and Its Victims, arguing that submission to that one act of degradation prepares many a young man for a career of crime. He took the reader through the experience of a youthful offender, which began with the accused, usually arrested for vagrancy or disorderly conduct, spending the night in the police station among older, more vicious criminals. He compared the criminal justice system to a great mill which, somehow or other, supplies its own grist, a maelstrom which draws from the outside and then keeps its victims moving in a circle until swallowed in the vortex. Altgeld was part of a movement headed by two prominent reformers, Lucy Flower and Julia Latrobe, whose work led to the establishment of the nation's first juvenile court in Cook County, Illinois, in 1899. Young offenders, these reformers argued, were different from adults. They were works in progress, malleable, and could be set on the right path if the law behaved like a stern but loving parent rather than as an instrument of punishment. The notion that juvenile offenders are fundamentally different from adult ones lasted for more than 80 years. Then came the crime wave of the late 1980s and early 1990s. As crack and guns flooded the cities and gangs battled over turf, the violent crime rate for juveniles ages 15 to 17 doubled, as did the violent crime rate for people ages 18 to 20. John J. DeLuo, Jr., a political scientist who was then at Princeton, argued that we were seeing a new kind of juvenile criminal, utterly unlike the misbehaving teens of the past. He called them super predators. A super predator is a young juvenile criminal who is so impulsive, so remorseless, that he can kill, rape, maim, without giving it a second thought, he explained. And he warned that the numbers of these fatherless, godless, and jobless teens were growing. By the mid-2000s, he predicted their numbers would double or even triple, unleashing a tidal wave of violence across the nation. As many as half of these juvenile super predators could be young black males. DeLuo wrote in a 1996 article entitled My Black Crime Problem and Ours. In response, one state after another enacted direct file laws that allowed juvenile offenders to be transformed to adult courts if they committed certain crimes. There are no violent offenses that are juvenile, thundered Newt Gingrich, who was then Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. You rape somebody, you're an adult. You shoot somebody, you're an adult. California's Proposition 21 was approved by 62% of the voters in March 2000. Billed as a way to get tough on gang violence and drive-by shootings. The measure increased the sentences for a number of different crimes, and it gave prosecutors the power to decide on their own if they wanted to file charges in adult court against offenders as young as 14. Previously, prosecutors, wanting to charge a juvenile as an adult, had to make their case in a fitness hearing before a juvenile court judge. Prop 21 allowed them to make the call on their own in certain cases and made the call for them in others. Some crimes, mostly sex crimes, now had to be prosecuted in adult court. 9 months after the passage of Proposition 21, 30% of all teen offenders in California were being charged as adults. In some counties, the percentage was much higher. In San Diego County, for example, 3 out of every 4 young people were charged as adults by the end of that first year. This wasn't because more juveniles were committing crimes. Juvenile arrest rates began to fall in 1994, and they have continued to fall ever since. Today, the FBI's Juvenile Violent Crime Index, which measures arrest for murder, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault, is lower than it was in 1980, and that's true across racial lines. The violent crime rate among black youths, in fact, has dropped by 60% in the past 2 decades, and the homicide rate has dropped by 82%. The super predator apocalypse was a myth, yet many of the laws that the scare put on the books are still used. While California voters effectively repealed Proposition 21 in 2016, many states continue to routinely treat juveniles as adults. Each year, an estimated 250,000 U.S. juveniles are transferred into adult courts. In California, 3/4 of these juveniles are transferred by prosecutors using the discretion given to them by Proposition 21. This discretion has not been evenly applied. In 2012, analysis by California's Department of Justice found that cases against black youths were more than twice as likely to be directly filed in adult court than cases against white youths, and cases against Latino youths were more than 6 times as likely. And the disparity didn't end there. Once they landed in adult court, young black and brown offenders were also much more likely to serve time. Just 1/3 of white youths were sentenced to adult or juvenile state correctional facilities in 2012, while 2/3 were given probation or sentenced to serve time in county jails. For kids of color, the ratios were reversed. 2/3 serve time in state facilities, while 1/3 received probation or jail. Nationally, 58% of all incarcerated African American youths are serving their time in adult prisons. "What he did was a terrible thing," Jasmine said after Richard was charged. "I'm not trying to defend his actions because it was very terrible. Even so," she said, "Richard was a kid who was capable of making an exceedingly dumb mistake, but one who was also capable of learning from it." "Life in jail? A 16-year-old? It's ridiculous," she said. "They need to give him time to grow. Why lock him up and have him institutionalized and make him worse?" Court date. On November the 7th, the day Richard made his first court appearance, reporters packed the hallways. "What kind of boy is he?" one shouted as Jasmine and her sister Juliet stepped into the elevator with Richard's grandmother. "He's a good kid, a very good kid," the grandmother, also named Juliet, said. "Why do you think he did this?" another reporter asked. "I don't know. He was with his friends, joking around, that's all," she said. "He's not a bad person. If you knew him, you'd know he's always joking around," Richard's Aunt Juliet said in a separate interview. "He shouldn't have did what he did. I feel so bad." Jasmine spoke to the press, too, off camera. "I am very sorry for my son's actions," she said. "I did not raise my son that way." That's what they said. But all anyone seemed to hear was this. He was joking around. Setting someone on fire because of their clothes is not a joke or prank gone awry, editorialized the Bay Area Reporter, a newspaper serving the LGBTQ community. As Alameda County prosecutors correctly see it, it's a felony, and Richard surely isn't laughing at the possibility of life in prison because he apparently couldn't handle someone dressing differently. Online forums seethed with outrage. To the mother of the 16-year-old who set the fire, "You call that just joking around? Suppose some kid set you on fire, burn, say, 90% of your body. Would that be joking around? Your son needs life in prison for attempted murder," a man named Brian Wheel wrote on an anti-bullying Facebook page. The comment received 160 likes. On news sites, blogs, and forums around the country, the conclusion was the same. Lock him up, throw away the key, lock up the mother too while you're at it. Many suggested far worse. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the book, The 57 Bus. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.